When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition Comic Book Podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
And that would be me. Hello, Paul.
Hello, how are you? We got a lot to talk about. We're going to run through this really quickly. Today on the program, we will be discussing The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen by Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill, which should prove to be a lively discussion.
Could be.
But first, at the time of this recording, just a few days ago, James Gunn announced the new slate of DC movies and TV shows that he will be spearheading for the, which company is it now? Is it Warner Brothers, Discovery, HBO? Who is doing this now? Okay. But it's a very interesting list of things.
And because it's Discovery, all of these will actually be scripted reality TV shows.
Yes, indeed. At Home with the Supermans. Batman Boo Boo. Which actually won't be too far from the truth. So anyway, it's a really interesting list of things. First and foremost, he confirmed that the new Flash movie with the troubled star Ezra Miller will be released, and it will be the focal point. It'll be Flashpoint. Right. They're gonna reboot everything. I'm really interested to see how this is gonna come out, because I don't know. Gunn didn't give any indication that Ezra Miller was going to be staying on.
Right.
So this might be their last outing.
Right, well, now. And you know, I mean, there's a perfectly serviceable Flash out there right now who will be unemployed soon.
He did well. How many seasons of the TV show is there now?
I think it was 63.
63, yes. And they all had a speedster as the villain.
Right, 63 seasons. Mm-hmm.
Did they end up saving the city? Or was that was Arrow?
I stopped watching. which is terrible, you know, because Grant Gustin is not the problem.
Oh, no.
I thought, well, I think we've covered this ground before where, I think he was great. I mean, he just really has that Barry Allen feel to him.
Right. He's got that, you know, innocent charm, but at the same time, he can be serious and nasty when he needs to be. So
The show was really fun for a few seasons.
It might be again. Who knows?
I stopped watching.
All of those shows seem to go on for too long, with the exception of Legends of Tomorrow.
Hello, come on, James Gunn.
Yeah. Well, there's some new things. Let's talk about the new slate.
Let's talk about what's coming up.
So after Flashpoint, it's basically going to be a rebooty of the DCEU. Let's start with the movies. So right. Superman Legacy, written by Gunn, is going to be a complete overhaul of Superman, a reboot of the Man of Steel Zack Snyder stuff, which right. I need to say, thank God.
We're not Snyder bronies, right?
No. And Superman should be hopeful and, you know, bright and colorful and not a brooding guy who snaps people's necks.
Right.
Yeah.
They have another guy that does that. They've already got a broody guy.
Yes, they have several broody guys.
Yeah.
That's why you need
one most famously.
Yeah, so it looks like Gunn has been tweeting pictures of All-Star Superman saying, which is just wonderful. That's one of the best Superman stories in existence. It just looks like it's going to be a brighter, happier Superman, which...
Shiny, happy Superman.
Yeah, a hopeful Superman. Oh, my goodness. I am looking forward to that. And there might be a black Superman as well.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, noes.
That's been in the...
Chuck Dixon know about this?
That's been in the rumor mill for a while that Ta-Nehisi Coates would be writing a black Superman movie to be either produced or directed by J.J. Abrams or J.J. Abrams.
As the kids say.
And apparently, I did not see this, but you did. Apparently, Ta-Nehisi Coates let it slip that this is a real thing happening.
Yeah, well, I think he let it slip on a news program. He was being interviewed on a news program, and he kind of let it slip that he was working on Superman, and then I think realized that he wasn't supposed to say that.
I mean, it doesn't come as a surprise that we all kind of assumed he was working on it, but cool. I really want to see a really good Superman on screen again. Not to say anything about Henry Cavill. Henry Cavill's great.
Again, it's, you know, I choose not to blame the actors or,
right.
Well, in The Flash, maybe I do, but, or the Flash movie that's coming, but, you know, you can only work with what you're given. And I think as we talk about a little bit, some of these things coming up from DC, I will just be so happy if they can get rid of that weird visual effects, dark sky.
Yeah.
3000, you know, the whole Snyder thing, like that whole look has kind of,
it's that oversaturated, just dark and broody.
It's just and the effect that's used has always irritated me.
There's a criticism on the Marvel movies that it's just bland, but at least they have colorful costumes and it looks like a comic book,
right?
Well, that brings us to the next big hero from the DC, from DC Comics, and they're going to be doing a rehaul of Batman, doing Batman the Brave and the Bold. Now, though, this is not going to affect the Batman. There's going to be a The Batman sequel that's going right. to be kind of an Elseworlds thing, that's what I assume. So you can still have your broody, dark, rainy, sad Batman that lasts for 3 hours. If you're into that sort of thing, yeah, you still got it.
Keep it to just 3 hours.
Yeah, so Robert Pattinson, who did a fine job in that movie. So that's still going to get a sequel. But now we're going to have also The Brave and the Bold, which will focus on the Bat family. So apparently this is going to be based on the Grant Morrison run, another Grant Morrison-based superhero.
I wonder if the Superman's really going to be, because All-Star Superman is kind of unfilmable. So I feel like, I wonder if Gunn is just going to bring in elements of it as opposed to it being based.
I have a feeling he's going to be doing it the same way he did Guardians, where he based it on those, the modern runs of Guardians. He based it on that, but he actually put his own spin on things. That's what I assume is going to be the same thing.
Yeah. And so with Brave and the Bold, it's focusing on Damian Wayne.
So Robin could be the broody one and Batman could be the responsible parent. I'm using responsible parent in quotes.
Because Batman is known as a responsible parent. Or, I'm sorry, Bruce Wayne is known as a responsible parent.
That's right. You know, a somewhat chipper Batman would be nice to see. You know, you don't have to go full Adam West, but you can still have a guy who enjoys living his life for the most part.
And if they don't somehow utilize Batcowl, you know, you got to. Come on.
Yeah, and put Batmite in there. And yeah. This looks like, again, this just looks like a lot of fun. I like where this is going. And then we get The Authority. Brian, how do you feel about The Authority?
You'll probably have to cut my ABCAB comment. So The Authority, I mean, I really, like, I think we've talked numerous times about actually doing The Authority, but I think held back on that based on some creator issues.
It's a wild storm of controversy.
But I think that could be really interesting. I feel like The Authority is probably kind of close to a Peacemaker. We'll see. We have no idea. You know, again, what we're seeing is that James Gunn is taking, I don't want to say like the Marvel sort of idea where they would have their big name characters, but then Marvel has done a very good job of focusing even in their films on some what we call B-list, C-list, D-list, what have you, characters, and giving them, you know, major props. I mean, it's Ant-Man and
Rocket Raccoon and Groot are
right, and the whole Guardians of the Galaxy. I do not believe that James Gunn will just try to ape a Marvel, you know, model, but I do appreciate the fact, and we're going to see this like some of the other things we're talking about. I mean, the Creature Commandos.
You're jumping ahead, man. You're jumping ahead in the list. But yes.
But no. I like the fact that, you know, DC has been so focused on, you know, the big three and the big moments and these sort of over the top bombastic films. Yeah. I think Shazam was able to kind of give a little bit of fun.
Absolutely.
Although Black Adam was terrible.
I haven't seen it yet. And I'm kind of dreading it.
Except for Pierce Brosnan as Dr. Fate, which was fun. But, you know, it's they're bringing in what seems like some fun. And it, like in the same way that the Harley Quinn is just a blast, right? I mean, yes. It's so much fun. Apparently Harley Quinn is safe.
As opposed to Doom Patrol and Titans, which have been canceled. Doom Patrol's another one that brought in fun.
Right. You know. But we talk privately, let's be honest. Doom Patrol getting 4 seasons is kind of astonishing.
I was actually surprised it got one. But, yeah.
And apparently they are being given time now to finish the last few episodes of Doom Patrol to wrap it up. I mean, this is great. So The Authority, you know, it's got like that Peacemaker feel to it, mm-hmm. I think. We don't know. We don't know anything about what they're going to be about yet. About.
Yes.
But it's an interesting, doing the Authority is an interesting flex.
Well, it seems that James Gunn seemingly has an absolute love of the material and a deep knowledge of the characters and the lore. So much so that he's able to grab these D-list characters and bring them forward and do something new with them. Okay, let me say that again. He has a love of the material and a knowledge of the lore, but he's not afraid to change it to make a better story. And I like that about him. So next in the movie world is going to be an adaptation of Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, based on Tom King's run on Supergirl, which was phenomenal.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom King, and let's call it, you know, it's Tom King and Bilquis Everly, because they made that, the art helped make that. Tom King always gets great artists, right?
Yeah, he does. I wonder if that's because he does such short runs that he can say, you know, you're only going to get 12 issues. Can you just knock it out of the park for me?
But with the Supergirl thing, there's your galactic, there's your otherworldly. Exactly. I know where we've got Green Lantern coming up too, although I think that's going to be more focused Earth side.
Yeah, well,
which I've really missed in Green Lantern comics recently. Well, over the past 15 years.
There's a whole wealth. We've talked about this before, whereas Marvel's more grounded, mm-hmm. and DC's more of the, you know, epic mythological cosmic thing for the most part. Yeah, at least the Marvel movies have been doing more cosmic than DC has, which is kind of surprising.
Absolutely. And so it feels like with the Supergirl, it's their opportunity to kind of go cosmic if it really is based on the Tom King limited series.
James Gunn himself said it out of his mouth. He said it will be based on Tom King's run. We'll see.
We really only know announcements and bare bones.
Still, it's good. It's fun to talk about. I mean, I like the direction that they're going. So let's move on to TV. You already mentioned it, Creature Commandos.
Yep.
So the original Creature Commandos were actually the universal horror monsters coming together to fight in World War II. Don't think that's the team now. They're going to
I think they're gonna focus on, I think, Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein are both going to be characters in this. Two characters that I think have been fantastic in their representation, basically since Seven Soldiers of Victory, since Morrison's Seven Soldiers on, and then there was that Frankenstein series. Was that Lemire?
I think it was cobbled together by a bunch of different...
Right.
Because that's a Frankenstein joke there. Thank you.
Yeah, Frankenstein Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. was a hoot. What a fun comic book that was.
Not S.H.I.E.L.D. I think it was Shade.
Oh, Shade.
Frankenstein Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. would be interesting.
Would be kind of interesting, too. Yes, yeah. But Frankenstein Agent of Shade. So, I mean, I'm pretty enthused about this. Now, I think it makes sense that it's animated.
No. And it's great. You know, DC animation is good. Marvel animation is hit or miss, but DC animation is, for the most part, pretty solid.
I think they've done a lot. DC has done a better job at animation. Marvel has done a better job at film.
There you go.
and TV, both of them have had hits and misses.
Exactly. Now we're going to get the first live action TV show. It's going to be Waller, based on Amanda Waller. And it's sort of going to be a bridging story between the first season of Peacemaker and the second season of Peacemaker.
Right. And we're going to have a delay on Peacemaker, which is sad.
But if it's a delay in order to make it better and not rushing it out, I'm good with that. You know?
Well, and I wonder how Waller's going to collapse into the Authority.
Oh, yeah. And Creature Commandos.
I feel like that needs to be connected somehow.
We will see. This is the one I'm kind of least anticipating. But I said the same thing about Peacemaker, and I was completely wrong on that.
Right. And if it's James Gunn using his Peacemaker template on Waller. Now, obviously, like some of this is James Gunn as showrunner or overall showrunner.
Yeah, he's Kevin Feige.
Right. And I feel like James Gunn is a cat who is going to be happy to let creators run loose. Right. So he's the showrunner. He's the overall mind behind it all. But I feel like he's a guy who like will not exercise some of the same control issues that certain other DC showrunners have done in the past.
Well, not to keep dumping on Snyder, but to make every film had to be that desaturated gloom.
Yeah.
And
and let's be honest, both Snyders.
Both Snyders?
Well, Jeff Snyder.
Oh, yes, yes.
Has also been involved in some of this, and it just hasn't turned out well.
And it feels, again, speculation, but it feels as if James Gunn is very creator focused. So if someone has a vision for something, he'll allow them to just do their style.
And we don't know for certain. All of this is, nothing's in the can yet, as far as we know. Although I think some of these announcements have come after things have already begun to be set in motion.
I think things are, yeah. So pre-production, if not beginning production, is beginning. That doesn't make sense at all. I can't speak today. That doesn't bode well for an audio podcast.
We am good talk today.
we talk good.
but we should also mention, I don't know if you were going to mention this, but also I believe we're getting Paradise Lost.
Yes. I was going to end it off with Paradise Lost, but let's just talk about it now, which is a prequel to Wonder Woman, how Wonder Woman came to be.
And I think this is going to have some input from Kelly Sue DeConnick's incredible 3-issue,
yes,
Prestige, Black Label, whatever it is, that finally we got our final. We finally see
we're both doing the same thing. Cool.
Yeah, it's just it's that kind of day. But we finally got the third issue of Kelly Sue DeConnick's series drop this just a month ago, I think. Wow, it would have made my best of last year and probably the year before. How many years have we been waiting for these 3 issues to finish? I understand why the artists she has on the series are not fast, but boy howdy did they come to the table on it. And Kelly Sue DeConnick's writing is aces as usual. Mm-hmm. So I think what I've been given to understand reading the rumors is that her run there is going to play a part in this series as well. So, which excites me very much.
Yes, indeed. All the buzz around this is saying it's going to be Game of Thronesy. That's just something that people throw out there to say that, anytime something is political intrigue these days, it's Game of Thronesy. But,
and it could be any, Shakespeare-based or British-based, right, medieval Renaissance.
Well, that one looks pretty darn interesting. And then you had already alluded to, there's going to be a Lanterns TV series, which will focus on Hal Jordan and Jon Stewart. So they're going to be doing news parodies on a nightly TV show. Oh, wait, different Jon Stewart.
it's just, there's a lot of interesting things being thrown out there on all of this. We may have a Blue Beetle.
Well, Booster Gold.
And a Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, yeah, separately, not as the...
There's definitely going to be a Booster Gold TV show, which I just, wow. That's a, I know Booster Gold is beloved in comic book fandom, but in the general world out there who's not in our bubble, no one knows who Booster Gold is.
Yeah, and, you know, how frustrating was it? Like, Booster Gold getting that scene at the end of Legends of Tomorrow, and we're like, yes, and then no. But I'm also very curious about the Blue Beetle. I believe, if I read correctly, it's going to be the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle. I am going to be in the minority here and say I love the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle. I read the Keith Giffen Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle when it came out. Those are comics that I still have kept and haven't sold off or, you know, what have you. I really like Jaime Reyes as the Blue Beetle. I know Ted Kord is the beloved.
Well, we'll see, but, you know, I can't trust your opinion because you're a woke soy boy. But no, it is good. Those were good stories.
Has so much more potential than Ted Kord at this point.
Well, it's the same thing with, you know, with Marvel's and doing Ant-Man. They started with Scott Lang. Yes. Yes. Oh. Hank Pym is in it, but he's not the focus of right. The, maybe it'll be the same thing.
Yeah.
You can have Reyes as the main and then Kord as the sort of the mentor. Who knows?
So, yeah, but I think ultimately with all of this, and, you know, we just kind of generically ran down a list and gave our opinions on what it may or may not be, which may have nothing to do with the end result. But I am cautiously optimistic about where they're going.
I am too. I'm actually excited about this because, you know, other DC rundowns have always been so, like you said, Trinity focused. But it's always been so dire. Everything's always, you know, everything's so sad and has to be serious.
That's important. It's good to have there should be consequences. And, you know, I mean, even Marvel, like the whole Thanos stuff. I mean,
yeah, but there was still some joy in it. Yeah. I recently watched Wakanda Forever. I didn't actually go see it in the theaters, but it's streaming now and I watched it. And it's a very good film, but it's also very, you know, it focuses heavily on the death of Chadwick Boseman.
Right.
In the story, as the death of Black Panther. But there is a lot of sadness in that, and it's just, and a lot of drama to come from it. So you can do a good, you know, exciting superhero movie and still have that weight, that seriousness behind it. But it doesn't have to be overwhelming and oppressive the way that the Snyder films have been.
Which is why I think, to go back to the Harley Quinn, I think that's why that the Harley Quinn show, whether people are burnt out on Harley Quinn or not is beside the point. My goodness, the show, besides being utterly filthy, which is great, it's just the sheer joy of and manic craziness of those episodes has been a breath of fresh air. It's why it's the show everybody, and the same with Doom Patrol, where it's just like, we're just going to be nuts. We're just going to be crazy.
The main, you know, the main villain. We're this have
creatures that are asses.
Literally. Yes, I was going to say the main villain of this is are cannibal zombie asses.
Right, and Peacemaker the same way. It just was like, let's just. But Peacemaker has a heart.
Exactly. Well, that's what things. That's what James Gunn can do. I mean, in the Suicide Squad, it's bonkers and just, you know, really silly until it's not anymore, and he hits you with that little tweak. That said, you know, I remember watching it. I go, oh my God, did you just make me feel something?
Yeah.
I'm genuinely touched right now.
Right. And you can have, you know, and DC has missed that in the, you know, I love Batman, but my goodness.
Batman doesn't have to be a brooding sad man all the time. I mean, there's 50 years more of comics that run the gambit from your Adam West style craziness to the brooding Batman.
Right.
You could have different stories. It doesn't have to be sad men in the rain all the time.
Right. And you know, it's what's his face? First Batman, Tim Burton. The Burton Batman was pretty fun.
Yeah, right? It was.
Because he was able to work in broody Batman and also kind of goofy.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about casting Keaton. Mm-hmm. He was able to have the brooding Batman, but Keaton could add some, you know, I don't know, not joy, but some, you know, charisma. And
right. And Burton mixed in like that kind of 60s era Batman craziness.
Exactly. So, you can have, and again, you don't have to go full camp like the Schumacher stuff, you know.
Right. Or it was just silly.
Right.
And silly without a point.
So there has to be a happy medium. And I think maybe Brave and the Bold will get there. Yeah. Who knows?
We will find out. We're years away from seeing any of this.
Yeah, but
I mean, maybe next year, like 2024, I think maybe we'll start to see some of this stuff.
Yes, but the first ones are supposed to start coming out next year.
Yeah. So, you know, we could all be dead by that point. Yeah. Who knows?
Maybe the Flash movie will come out at some point. I don't know. Or maybe it already has. Flashpoint has happened, and it was actually released 2 years ago.
Oh, geez.
Who knows? But I like you said, cautiously optimistic. But it just seems like a very... I like the direction this is going, or seems to be going.
Things seem to be going in a good direction. Yeah, good direction. I just repeated exactly what you said, almost word for word.
Yeah.
So, well done. And we'll see what happens. But... A cause for hope.
A light at the end of the tunnel. A lantern to guide our way, you could say. All right, let's take a break and come back and talk about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which, again, should be an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
Need a podcast talking about weird stuff? Well, then we've got just the thing for you. Into the Weird, a podcast chronicling the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age of comics, featuring the voice talents of Mr. Billy Delicious.
Hola.
Mr. Herman Hellstrom Lowe.
Hey there.
And straight from the Long Box of Darkness, his infernal majesty Dormammu.
How are you?
And many more. But wait a minute. You might be thinking, aren't all comics infused with a grain of weirdness? I mean, Reed Richards can stretch every single part of his body, right? And why did Ultron design the Vision with working genitalia? Well, you would be correct, but Into the Weird isn't just any regular comic book show, folks. We focus on the really bizarre. Here are a few examples.
A sword and sorcery barbarian grown spontaneously from a jar of peanut butter.
A duck running for president of the United States.
Benjamin Franklin playing hide the sausage with Doctor Strange's girlfriend, Clea.
A giant-sized man-thing lamenting the death of a clown.
A serial killer obsessed with killing only fools, dressed as cavalier with laser guns after witnessing a priest fornicating.
And so much more. So if you like the wonderful weirdness of the Bronze Age from 1970 to 1985, and characters such as Ghost Rider, Morbius, The Defenders, Man-Thing, Son of Satan, Skull the Slayer, Killraven, Howard the Duck, and the weird granddaddy of them all, Dr. Stephen Strange, then this is the show for you.
ITW's on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and TuneIn. Hit subscribe. And join us for a comic-filled jaunt into the weird.
And we're back. Paul, today we are reading your recommendation, which is Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, or at least the first six issues. We are not doing the Black Dossier because we're not insane. Would you like to tell us a little bit about this interesting comic book?
I will indeed. When I was a kid, I had a pretty extensive collection of Mego dolls. These were articulated action figures about 8 inches high, and the manufacturer Mego had the rights to make characters from various companies and franchises, like Marvel and DC, but also things like Star Trek and the Planet of the Apes. And at playtime, I would go to my toy chest and I'd pull out a variety of dolls and I'd create adventures for them to go on. Captain Kirk would travel the stars with Superman and Dr. Zaius. Captain America, Batman, and Mr. Spock would solve crimes and fight criminals across the globe. And it didn't matter that none of these characters made sense being together. All that mattered was how far I could stretch my imagination and the joy I had creating stories for them and how elaborate I could make those stories. In 1999, Alan Moore went to his toy chest and pulled out his favorite literary action figures and smashed them together in what was to become the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Now, the premise is a simple one. Mina Murray, aka Mina Harkness of Dracula fame, must travel the world to assemble a team of men with special powers. Extraordinary powers, you might say. The team includes Alan Quatermain, Captain Nemo, Dr. Harry Jekyll and his alter ego, and Hawley Griffin, the Invisible Man. And you might call these people gentlemen, but only in the loosest sense of the word. Once assembled, the team must learn to work together, tame their inner and outer demons, and attempt to thwart a gang war between Professor Moriarty and Dr. Fu Manchu. Just don't say his name. Now, if the premise is simple, the details are a bit more complicated. Alan Moore crams as many literary references from a multitude of genres as he possibly can into a single page or a bit of dialogue. It's a veritable Where's Waldo of Gothic and Victorian novels. And for the most part, Moore does this with skill and some subtlety. And part of the fun of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is attempting to find these references. It's genuinely clever. And all this is aided by the highly stylized and lurid illustrations of Kevin O'Neill. There's a flip side to this. Alan Moore is undeniably one of the most creative and innovative writers in comics. His contributions to the medium are monumental, and he deserves all the accolades he gets. He does, however, have certain proclivities. Moore constantly puts his female characters in danger of physical and sexual violence. He relishes in racist tropes. He generally demoralizes his characters and does this with a smug, self-satisfied flourish. Now, this could be said to be on purpose, that by pointing out the evils of the world, he is thus criticizing and making the reader aware of the horrors of those evils. But Moore seems to want to have his cake and eat it too. He seemingly wants to skewer and criticize the repressive morals and failings of the Victorian age, but at the same time, he indulges in them. And all of this is compounded by the highly stylized and lurid illustrations of Kevin O'Neill. In the end, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is a creative tour de force, an overflowing toy chest full of rich ideas from one of the greatest minds in comic books, but sadly, also one of its most flawed. Brian, what did you think of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
So this reminds me of when we've had a couple other comics that we've covered. So this reminds me of when we talked about The Boys, and also when we talked about Frank Miller's Daredevil. Which took
you forever to get over to
which caused me some vapors.
Yeah.
Because we're talking Victorian, gave me some vapors in our initial discussion. We had to table it for a week before I could recover.
Yes. That almost ended our friendship.
Well, no. Not even close. But referencing those things is we were talking about pieces of work or creators who have a level of great respect, and but we also had some serious misgivings about creator intent or the finished product on the page.
Again with League of Gentlemen,
I believe falls pretty solidly in that realm. I don't think we will be quite as harsh as we were on The Boys, and I don't think that we, either of us, have a hatred of a creator quite as strong as when we talked about Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope I got across, but I mean, Alan Moore is one of the greatest writers of comic books, hands yes. down. He's in the yeah. pantheon.
It's,
and I, yeah.
you know, well, I don't want to say we couldn't, it's inarguable because it's comic books. You will always have something to argue about, which is fun.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, Moore is one of the greatest comic book writers, hands down, but he has issues.
Yeah. He's written a lot of issues.
Yes, he does. Yes. He has collected editions.
Yeah. So that said, is this vastly entered? Were we entertained?
Oh, yes.
Did I have to remember to keep my phone nearby me with Wikipedia up? Yes.
Just to address that, I started that, like the first couple of issues, I was kept looking through and like, oh, what does this mean? And what does this mean? Is that a reference? And then I finally just said, okay, stop.
Yeah, I gave up too.
I'm not enjoying the story if I have to keep going back for references. So.
Well, and therein lies one of the flaws.
Explain. Elaborate.
I have a particular writer of fiction. We'll just refer to him as DFW, whom I despise. And this writer is very, very popular. Very, very, you know, among the literati and, you know, lonely boys and whatnot.
You're kidding me. You jest infinitely.
I do. Like, one of the reasons I find this particular writer's work to be garbage is that this writer not only footnotes their fiction pieces, they footnote their footnotes. And a lot of the footnotes are drawing our attention to how clever the author is, as opposed to contributing to the narrative of the story.
Yes, it's like waving a sign that says, look at me, look at me, look how clever I am. Aren't I smart?
When you're footnoting your footnotes, Kurt Vonnegut can do it, and it's hilarious because it's referential to the story.
So, Kurt Vonnegut didn't take himself seriously either.
No, never did.
Yeah.
With League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and it goes back to what we're saying is, again, I was the same. It was like I was prepared to, and there is a Wikipedia page that just lists all of the characters mentioned in the comic, and you could look it up, and it gives you the source for the character. And some of them are, Alan Moore actually did create a couple of unique characters.
Did he?
Campion Bond is not a real, didn't exist. Although, let's be honest, we know who Campion Bond is the precursor to. It's some of this goes back to, there's an argument that Alan Moore has not really created, like a lot of Alan Moore's oeuvre has been using pre-existing characters. I don't think anybody, Alan Moore doesn't really, he creates avatars, but he's never...
He creates really excellent situations and storylines for these characters too.
But so League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, again, it's like we started off with, the whole thing is it's using existing Victorian era characters, like you said, smashing them together and creating something new.
He's an incredibly clever writer. And he has fascinating ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Execution can quibble about that, but but I agree with you. With the exception of maybe V for Vendetta, maybe he doesn't really create. You're right. He doesn't really create new characters. He takes pre-existing characters and makes them into something, and puts them into his own little. He's a dungeon master. He creates the world and then has the characters play in it.
Right. Yeah, he's got his own Moreverse.
There you go.
And that's fine. And someone is already whatabouting us at the moment. And I confess there are characters that he has created whole cloth. So you are right, Keyboard Warrior. But for the most part,
we're speaking in generalities. Yes,
right. The thing that he is most famous for is co-opting existing character. I don't want to say existing ideas because Alan Moore has a lot of great.
Oh yes, I mean what he's done, what he did with Swamp Thing is amazing.
Yes,
but these were pre-existing characters. What he did with Watchmen is amazing, but these were these were quote unquote pre-existing characters. They're based on pre-existing characters.
And John Constantine is Alan Moore's. So there's the caveat. One of my very favorite characters in all of comics is an Alan Moore creation.
Yes. You could argue that other people did him better, but that's...
We might need to fact check that. That has always been my belief. Someone's going to be like, well, actually, Rick Veitch did. I don't know. Or Barney Wright. Memory serves. And, you know, we're not scholars.
Again, we're speaking in generalities. Alan Moore does a great job of, whether it's a fairy tale character or a Victorian character from a novel, from a Gothic novel, he's very good at taking pre-existing characters and creating new scenarios and situations for them to thrive in. Again, we like Alan Moore. He's the best. He, He's the best magician snake handler. Crazy man to write for comics. But I, you know what? I'm gonna correct myself. I think Grant Morrison is the best magician snake handler in comic books.
So again, I'm not trying to, I think I'm trying to get the criticisms out of the way before, because there's lots in this comic that is great.
Yes, absolutely.
Lots of things that are great, but there are problems.
The problems are, and the thing is, they're not necessary, which we'll get into.
And the other quibble, let me just get the quibbles out of the way. We'll have a couple more, but no pun intended. The difficulty for me also is, you like Victorian literature.
I do, yes.
I am not generally a Victorian era. So you know, I'm coming into this without the love of the characters that other people would sort of already have ingrained who appreciate that era. I'm not criticizing the era. It's just not my favorite, let's say.
And I should narrow my focus. I really like Victorian Gothic literature. Some of the romances I could take or leave. Your Jane Eyres of the world. Yeah. I could just say, eh, not for me.
Right.
But give me a spooky house and a vampire and I'm all over it. And this comic, not so much in the first six issues, but it does give you eventually spooky houses and vampires.
Yes.
Yeah. What Moore does with this is, like I said, it's really creative. It's really well done for the most part. Yeah. He did a good job. It's the Justice League just with Victorian heroes, basically.
Right. It's Justice League of 1898.
There you go. And he does some good choices of the people the characters he chose to be on the team are very interesting.
And the characters that he pulls in subsequent issues or subsequent collections. So our main characters here are pretty much consistent through the first 12 issues.
Yes. And people come and go and time changes, but
right. Somebody gets eaten.
So I've already said it in the introduction, the characters are, it's led by Mina Murray, Mina Harkness.
Right.
So if you haven't read the original Dracula, Mina's a really great character in that novel. I'm sure you've read the original Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Yes. These many years ago.
Yeah. If you read that with a critical eye, I'm not going to say that Bram Stoker was, a feminist or anything, but Mina's character in that, she's always in peril, but at the same time, she's the one telling the boys, you need to do this now. You need to do this. So she has agency.
Which carries through in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Exactly. And that's what I was trying to get to, is that having her being the leader of this group makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Because she was a strong character in the original novel, and she did have some form of agency for a Victorian Gothic novel. So, and then you have Alan Quatermain, which I will admit, I have not read many Alan Quatermain novels or stories. I don't know. I mean, I get the gist of Alan Quatermain.
Imperialist, colonialist, big game hunter, great white man amongst the natives.
Speaking of natives, Captain Nemo is in this.
who maybe is my favorite representation in this.
Yeah.
He doesn't come off great in certain instances. I mean, he has a woman issue.
He is... And he's disparaged by a lot of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, he's really smart, obviously, and he's in control most of the time. Then you have Jekyll and Hyde. There is a nod in this. So in the original novel, in Robert Louis Stevenson's original novel, Hyde is actually smaller than Jekyll. Mm-hmm. Because when you're evil, it makes you tiny.
Right.
So, but that's not fun. So there is a reference that said, well, I started out small, but as time went on, I got bigger and bigger. It's like, okay, that was good. There was a little hand wave. That's why you just need a giant monster ripping people's arms off.
Quite graphically.
And then we have the Invisible Man, who is probably the most despicable character in this. And on purpose. So that's your team. That's your Justice League of Victorian heroes.
Yes, being commanded by Campion Bond, who is MI5. Is it MI5? I think it's MI5.
Oh, it's early. Maybe it's MI4.
and of course, the mysterious Mr. M.
Yes, which is obviously Mycroft Holmes.
Obviously.
I know it must be him because it's mentioned half a dozen times.
Yes.
And actually, you know, spoiler, it actually turns out to be Dr. Moriarty. So, yeah, so these first six issues are, for the most part, a getting the team together storyline. Right.
Yeah, the generic first couple issues. Generic is, I don't think you could ever apply the word generic to Alan Moore, but you know what I mean? It's the, let's get the band together.
Right. We have to travel the globe and find our, and assemble the team.
And then, of course, what follows is, plot-wise, it's kind of a basic plot.
A lot happens, but not a lot happens.
Right. Chase the bad guys, get the bad guys, suddenly bigger bad guys, and then you go after the bigger bad guys, and there's some twists, and there are kites and balloons and giant floating ships. And
lots and lots of opium.
And lots of opium, and apparently the evil Asian Empire.
Yes. Oh, Alan Moore. Or should I say, oh, Kevin O'Neill.
Well, I mean, it's a group effort.
Yes, yes, yes. All right, so I don't want to go through beat by beat, but we'll just give generalization, if you don't mind, if that's okay with you. We're just going to do some generalizations over each issue. Yeah. Because we don't really have to go into everything that happens.
Yeah.
So first issue, Mina Murray is recruited to go and find these people for Campion Bond to assemble this team. The first person she goes and gets is Alan Quatermain, who is an opium junkie passed out in an opium den. And right off the bat, we get our first problematic scene. Mina is trying to recruit Alan Quatermain. He's kind of opiumed out. And then she is assaulted. And there's an attempted rape, which is thwarted. Quatermain comes to his senses and, you know, they get out of there.
He's saved by the man.
Yes. But that did not need that. Why was that there? Is it supposed to be funny? Because it's played for laughs.
It's played for laughs.
You know, that was my first like, oh, Alan. Why? But it does. I mean, as far as storyline goes, beat for beat, it's just get the guys a little bit of peril. They're out of peril. They get on the giant ship, squid boat, the Nautilus. I'm going to be criticizing Kevin O'Neill quite a bit, but he's good as far as his backgrounds. Like, there's an opening scene where they're next to a bridge with these giant sculptures, you know, angel sculptures, and the way he draws the way he draws all the vehicles and the buildings, he's really good at that.
I think the world of Kevin O'Neill's art, and rest in peace, Kevin O'Neill, recently, that man can do caricatures like nobody's business, which is both a positive and a negative in this comic.
Yes, we're going to get, this really comes to the fore towards the end.
His overall art is stunning. And like you said, the background stuff is as fascinating as the foreground. For good or for ill.
Yeah, he adds some highly stylized, just beautiful artwork. We mentioned Tim Burton earlier. Think of the Tim Burton Batman films and all that gothic architecture, or not, maybe not gothic, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And Kevin O'Deal has his version of that. And it's beautiful. It really is. So the next on the list.
Forget also, remember, this issue, Mina Murray is not assaulted once, but twice.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Like, he works it in twice, because at some point he decides that she's going to be a prostitute. An undercover, because they're trying to find...
They're trying to find Hyde, which is, again, this is a nod to Alan Moore's creativity. Mm-hmm. He does a kind of a twist on the Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Right, yeah, he brings in Dupin.
And, spoilers for the Alan Poe story. Edgar Allan Poe, I should say. Edgar, spoilers for the Edgar Allan Poe story, but it's an ape that is the killer. And then he does the little twist where it's really Hyde, who kind of is apish. So clever. Again, the guy the guy knows his craft. Yes, I had forgotten that, yes, she has to be a prostitute. But then they get Hyde because there was nowhere for him to.
Yes. We all see it.
Yes. So that's two on the list. Three, I guess, because you have Nemo. And then they go into issue two, where they have to travel to Canada in a school for girls where the women are being assaulted.
Yeah, I mean, again, this one actually amused me.
It did, okay.
It amused me in that it is a reference to, for some reason, there is a lot of, so Paul and I used to work at a large independent bookstore in Denver.
Yes.
And we're both buyers at various times. And I was a genre fiction buyer. And so one of the areas that I ended up buying for was erotica. 90% of the erotica we carried were British spanking novels. Seriously. It was okay. Just, and they were all, and so apparently it was.
Yeah. I did not expect the conversation to go to British spanking novels, but continue.
Well, but it's Alan, he made a very strong push to reference what I think is a big British, I don't necessarily want to call it a literary tradition, but a tradition in British literature or books with lots of spanking.
Okay.
Look it up. I mean, be very cautious when you look it up.
They're very cheeky reads.
Yeah. So this whole scene in the boarding school is completely, like, the woman in charge, Coot or whatever, is actually, so this was when I was still looking stuff up, but she actually is like a featured character back in like Victorian era spanking.
Wow. I did not know that.
Well, this is real. Well, it's not real. Nothing. Well, what is real? But this is an actual literary reference. The whole thing is a literary reference to a style of books being published in merry old England.
Wow. Okay. Well, that makes some of these scenes much more, I don't want to say palatable, but it makes much more sense now of why he would include that.
Yeah, that's why it's all there. Well, it's also, you know, he gets to work in some, it's not porn. It's not tastefully done either, but it's not.
He gets to work in some. So,
this is a complete and utter reference to an actual type of Victorian and going forward thing.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I learned something on this podcast. I don't know if I'm going to dive any deeper into this subject.
I wouldn't recommend it, but again, you know, have your safe searches on, kids.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Maybe use an incognito window. Just saying. Fire up that VPN. Wow. Okay.
Basically, so I keep saying basically. There's a bunch of young girls being impregnated at this school this is in England. I don't think it's Canada. It's Edmonton.
Oh, England. I thought it was England. I thought it was Canada. So
yeah, it doesn't matter. But what is it? I wrote it down. I had to write it down because it's awesome. The Miss Rosa Coots Correctional Academy for Wayward Gentlewomen. And the building is a butt.
And the what?
The building is a butt.
Yes, the building is a butt. This whole issue, boy.
It's Stern school marm, you know, just running around spanking young girls.
Oh my goodness. And then they have this, and then, of course, they're being impregnated by a ghost.
Right.
You know, which is, of course, the Invisible Man. It's just such a schoolboy fantasy. If I were invisible, I'd go to the girls' school and watch them shower. Yeah. It's like Porky's.
Right. I question the necessity. I understand that they're trying to build up Griffin as the scuzziest of them all. Like reading that whole, it amused me because I know the history of it. And I was a mix of amusement and is this necessary?
Exactly. You can do exactly what you were just talking about. without being adolescent about it. And that's what this feels like to me.
It's just, and Alan Moore has another piece of work that's a little more ick.
Lost Girls?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which came just before this.
Right.
Which was released. I shouldn't say it came just before this. But we do get in this, we do get Mina finally being, you know, a badass, where she figures out who he is. She throws a bucket of paint on him and then clocks him over the head. So she does. She is the one who figures all this out, and the boys don't have to save her.
But this is also the issue where we're introduced to Cavorite,
which is from
H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells, First Men in the Moon, which you have this stuff and it flies. It's
this green stuff for you to float.
It's hand wavium. It's just the stuff that causes you to float, which in the novel, the H.G. Wells novel, allows people to travel to the moon, where they meet bug people. It's very interesting.
And so our merry band of ne'er-do-wells are, of course, told by Campion Bond that, you know, they have to get this Cavorite. It's been stolen, and it's going to be used for a lunar expedition.
Again, very clever stuff. He's able to weave this in there. It's actually not just a throwaway line. It's actually integral to the plot.
And we also find out who it's in the hands of.
Which is the Doctor.
The Doctor. This is where things start to go south, right?
A little bit. So it's Dr. Fu Manchu, which is this is the second time on this program we're dealing with Fu Manchu. That's shocking to me. But yeah, so now they have to investigate Chinatown, the Chinese Quarter.
Limehouse.
Okay, I want to just point out, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of people standing around talking in this. In these comics, you know, it's a lot of dialogue.
It is. A lot of it's just throwaway. Well, it's not, and it is.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of I don't like women kind of dialogue, and I can't believe that woman's leading us. Right. I get where Alan Moore is coming, I don't get where he's coming from. I get where what he's attempting to do. Like I said in the introduction, you could say that he's pointing these things out on purpose, like he's doing it to shock us. To say, like, wasn't this horrible?
It's what we think he's doing.
Yeah, but he's also, like I said, reveling in it.
Right, like Campion Bond has the line, a waspish tongue, Miss Murray, is to my mind but one of the many unattractive features of the modern suffragette.
Yeah.
And Nemo has another line coming up that's also kind of it.
Well, yes. And of course, all of Holly Griffin's The Invisible Man's lines are just nasty. But even Quatermain, I mean, it's that whole Sam and Diane thing. I like you so much, so I'm going to be mean to you kind of a thing. This is such a mixed bag for me, Brian. It's like, I really appreciate the premise and the creativity behind it. But at the same time, Alan Moore, are you 15? What's going on? Anyway, they go to Limehouse, which is the Chinese Quarter, and Kevin O'Neill outdoes himself with caricatures.
Yeah.
Yes, his depiction of Asian people.
It's kind of gross.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a nice way of saying it, but it's
the one caveat I will give here is his depiction of just people in general, all the background individuals, pretty decadent. So this is not giving him a pass or an excuse, but like even the, let's call them the people, the good white people, him of London, right, in the background, they're all like missing teeth and doing terrible things and looking like shit and having growths on their faces.
Yeah, the great unwashed.
So the one thing I will say is, like, he's kind of equal opportunity in presenting all of humanity in the most kind of overarching, stereotypical, dilapidated way.
Okay. You're right. Yeah.
That's not a pass.
He's equal in his awfulness.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, I know this is deliberate. I know there's going to be people listening to this saying, like, well, you don't get it. I do get it. I don't have to like it.
Right.
All right, once we run through this story, we'll get into the philosophical idea of, we'll try to do some author intent. That's what I think we should do. Anyway, they do some investigating. The team does some investigating. They find out that the doctor is, there's something going on. How would you describe it? There's a plot, a hatching. So they're trying to, there's going to be.
Doctor as the Cavorite. What is he doing with it?
Exactly. And they're trying to figure this out. There's a lot of sitting and talking. And then they find, it's actually kind of a fun, they try to infiltrate the doctor's lair. Quartermain brings his elephant gun, but it's wrapped as a parcel. I think that was kind of funny. It's as if no one's going to know it's an elephant gun under his arm. And so there's a lot of, there's some interesting, you know, fun gags back and forth with Mina and Quartermain as they try to infiltrate. It's again, Sam and Diane kind of dialogue. But they infiltrate his organization. It's found that he's building a massive
steampunk ship.
Big giant steampunk ship with massive guns, and they're going to fly it over London to blow up the people.
Well, it's never so. What is weird is like the deviousness of this steampunk ship is not as well defined as the deviousness of the later steampunk ship.
Yes. Right?
So it's never clearly defined what the Doctor is going to do with this ship. So they're building a big ship with the Cavorite as to make it float, but it's never really clarified what they plan on doing with it. Whereas we know exactly what the later steampunk ship built by another group of people is intended for.
Yes. So, okay. We don't have. I said we're not going to go beat for beat, and we did. So I'm jumping ahead, man.
Let's just dive into this because we have a few things.
So as it turns out, it's Dr. Moriarty who is the mysterious Mr. M. He has survived the fight at Rickenbach Falls,
right?
And he has taken over MI5, and he has created a giant steampunk ship with which he's going to destroy London. For fun and profit. I believe
going back to the previous steampunk ship, through a series of wacky adventures, the Doctor's steampunk ship is destroyed. And the Cavorite is rescued.
And the Cavorite is rescued and returned to MI5, which then gets in the hands of Moriarty, who wants to use his steampunk ship to, like I said, he wants to destroy London for fun and profit. And there are two other reasons. Oh, shits and giggles, I believe.
Right. And he wants to destroy the East End particularly. Limehouse resides. But
yeah, also. He wants to destroy the poor people and the immigrants, which is, I believe, still the policy of the Tories.
But generally speaking, yes.
Yes, okay.
Possibly certain Florida governors, too.
So the Cavorite is liberated and given to Moriarty, who is going to basically destroy the poor sections in order to put up condos. You know, and he wants to gentrify London. And again, we're going to get into this, but Moore's making a political statement there in a kind of fun roundabout way. Moriarty launches his ship, and then the League must now stop him. You got to admit, the Victorian age, when they were going to build giant flying steampunk ships, they went out of their way. I mean, they didn't skimp on the detail.
They were quite lovely. Lots of space. I mean, you know, when you go into those ships, there's lots of the ceilings are high. I would never expect that.
Yeah, lots of light. They like to bring the outside in.
Yeah.
A little bit of whimsy. Like the Moriarty ship has a giant bat face on top of it. So, you know, it's the level of detail we don't see these days. Yeah. There's some fighting that goes on. There's lots of limbs ripped off and faces being shot. It's all and very.
I do want to say, like, while we're talking about the fighting scenes, it's Nemo is a badass. There are numerous shots of Nemo, like with harpoon guns or a harpoon Gatling gun, or Gatling too.
Yeah, sure.
Gatling, you know, like a harpoon, like a mini harpoon Gatling gun, and he just stands. I mean. It's the level of badass that Nemo is, but the violence, some of the violence, wow.
Yeah.
But in the final battle scene, we get like, the final battle scene is great. It just removes all the bad things, and it's like, it's a tour de force of, and this is where Kevin O'Neill shines.
Yes.
Right, when we remove and just the visual representation of everything. And, you know, I mean, the Doctor has like war kites, you know, and a cannon, and Nemo is up in a balloon. And
well, they take the balloon from Around the World in 80 Days.
Right.
Another Nemo, nice little reference.
Nemo and Hyde just like completely the sheer level of violence that Nemo and Hyde enact upon, you know, the bad guys in the steampunk ship, you know, to the point where even Miss Murray is like, that's unsporting.
Exactly.
Because Hyde is ripping people's limbs off and Nemo's literally, again, just standing there with his, this time with the Gatling gun, that's harpoons, not bullets, but harpoons. And he's just standing there, like, taking down dozens of people.
But then there's also, and the way Kevin O'Neill does this is beautiful and horrific at the same time. Like, where there's groups of people from the Doctor and Moriarty's forces fighting each other, and there's swords through faces and necks being cut open. Mm-hmm. But everything's really it's choreographed really well.
Yeah,
you know, or not choreographed, what's the word, composed really well. Yeah. So I mean, like you had said, this is where he shines. Mm-hmm. these fight scenes and the architecture and the ships, and it's really an exciting little moment. Everything is saved. The Cavorite is jettisoned to the sky.
With Moriarty
trying to stop it.
And what is it? Murray even says he's falling into the sky.
Yes.
It's Slim Pickens in Doctor Strange Love.
Yeah, in reverse.
In reverse.
Yeah. Okay. That's actually very clever. Yes, the ship is destroyed, the heroes prevail, they return to their home base just in time for things to fall from the sky. Martians, you might say.
But before that, right, Mycroft Holmes finally takes over as Mr. M.
Oh, yes. It was teased at the beginning, and it actually turns out to be true at the end. And everyone is kept in place because it's good to keep your enemies close.
Right. And they're also offered large amounts of money to stick around and be like the Justice League of Britain.
Exactly.
It's the JLE, the Justice League of England.
Yes. I like the idea of that. I will not. It's immoral to work for you. How much? Okay. Yeah. So obviously this is the setup. You have the premise in place, and the storyline will continue. Basically, it's War of the Worlds for the next storyline, which has been hinted at throughout the entire.
Yeah, because it's again Kevin O'Neill doing like some good work, you know, like with all the newspaper articles that are like in the background and.
Yeah, exactly. You see some headlines and, you know, and a few people mention it.
I just want to push this out there, is one of my favorite Kevin O'Neill moments is when the second steampunk ship is flying overhead of, you know, the East End, and you have this crowd scene of people looking up, and one of the people looking up at the ship is a guy wearing, you know, the pencil thing and, you know, saying blind. And he's looking up.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I made a note of that myself. It's like very nicely done. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the story itself. Let's do some author intent speculation.
Okay.
Because, you know, we're pretty good at taking what we've read and casting a critical eye upon it, I believe.
Yeah.
What is Alan Moore trying to say with this wonderful piece? Is it just a bit of over-the-top fluff? But as we alluded to, there are some actual political ideas he's trying to throw out there.
Right, right. I think the two things that struck me the most. So one is concentrated on Nemo. And it's even in the first issue where Mina and Nemo have a talk about India. I guess both of these things are about colonialism and imperialism. Or they kind of match up. And so, you know, there's a long discussion that, and it kind of continues. Nemo makes references to this throughout, and it's the idea of, you know, because he's a rebel, he's mm-hmm. He's part of the resistance against you know, the Raj, essentially, right?
Well, and British control,
and British control. And also, so there's that. And I think that plays into, because you also have, again, going back to the what I would call the Asian problem in the comic, which is also, like you've said, Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill trying to make a point, although I think badly, about that. But then there's also, like, when Moriarty talks about the state creating, where Moriarty basically says, am I the villain who is in charge of the government, or in charge of the MI5, or which, whatever he's in charge of, or am I the good guy pretending to be evil? Right. So it's like, so those are the two kind of primary, like, I thought those were like the most important sort of concepts that I think Alan Moore tries to work into this.
Yeah, I think he hit the nail on the head with the very anti-colonialism. And right. In addition to that, I mean, it's very well noted that Alan Moore was anti-Thatcher.
Right.
I think that's well documented in not only his work, but also his interviews and writing in general. So, and you see that with, he's creating this corrupt government agency with the villain at its head, and everyone spouting these words of saying, like, oh, we're just doing it to help the people, but really they're doing it to help the elite.
Right. And the whole, like, pro-Britain sort of aspect that runs through this, I think he is really trying to undermine that concept. The fact that it's the great heroes of Britain. Well, they're not heroes, but, you know, it's...
Yes.
He's taking the Victorian literature of the time and the so-called major characters within the literature and kind of juxtaposing them against the reality.
Exactly. And he's making valid points and truly doing a valid critique of these institutions and these ideals. But yeah, it seems as if he's indulging in those stereotypes in order to make a point, but that point gets lost because he's indulging in the stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I think that's ultimately that's the biggest flaw of this comic. It's incredibly creative. Alan Moore does a fantastic job of creating this world and weaving all these different stories together to create a new one. Kevin O'Neill does a fine job of visualizing all of this, but it is the indulgence. That's the only word I can keep coming up with.
Right. Well, but that's, so the intent is supplanted by the indulgence. When you carry a thing to an extreme to make a point, is the point being made, or does the extreme overtake the point?
Right. The point gets lost.
I realize that might have been word salad.
No, the point gets lost in the excess. I don't know. I obviously, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is one of those comics that's in the pantheon of great comic books. It certainly did a hell of a lot for Vertigo.
So. Was it Vertigo?
No, it's not Vertigo.
It was America's Best.
America's Best. let me say that again. It didn't certainly...
Which yeah. folded into Wildstorm. I'm getting the timeline a little screwy here, because it may have been released, like the trades might have had at some point a Vertigo, the Vertigo imprint on it. I don't know for certain, but it was initially his company, you know, the America's Best, which was bought out by Wildstorm, and then Wildstorm bought out by DC.
Right. I mean, there are versions that are on Vertigo now.
Yeah.
Or we're on Vertigo, but Vertigo's not a thing. You know what? Let's start again. it certainly did a lot for America's Best as far as, a small independent company getting a lot of sales. Alan Moore is just one of those creators where, God, I'm so impressed by him, but also, seriously, dude, relax.
Yeah, and rein in impulse.
Exactly. And that's where, he very famously has split with Marvel and DC because he didn't have full control.
And for good reason.
Yes, he has good reasons. But also, editors and editorial restraint can be a good thing for a story. You only need to see, some of Stephen King's mid-career novels going, oh, you didn't have an editor. That's why it's 3,000 pages. I think a lot of his excess, he's allowed to indulge in that excess because it's just him and he can do whatever he wants to. And sometimes that's the detriment of the story itself.
And I think subsequent League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics, particularly after he moved away from America's Best, and you get into some of the later things, and there's a correction made, whether it's intentional or not. The stories get goofier and kind of more dense, but he also pulls back in some ways some of the tendencies that he showed in the earlier League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics.
He grows a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. And I still think that the Moriarty bit about, you know, the good guy pretending to be a bad guy or the bad guy pretending to be a good guy is a incredibly great statement.
Yes.
On politics in general. And I'm not saying one side, you know, I'm not, but
there's good people on both sides.
Basically, like the state wants to create the state generically needs a bad guy and they need a good guy.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the strongest message of this entire comic, even more than the imperialism and colonialism. And it's kind of a brief bit in the comic, but you see, like, when you read that, then you see the overarching story and you're like, oh, that's what this is about.
And this also the idea of, you know, creating a villain in order to, there's a capitalist ideal or anti-capitalist ideal of, you know, I need to clear these people out of here.
Right.
Because I want to make a profit on this land. So I will create a villain to have that, to get the people behind me to do that.
But the good guy creating the villain is also the villain who's creating the good guy.
Yes. Same. I mean, there's a lot going on in there. Yeah. I mean, there's, I'll say it again. Alan Moore is very clever. He's a very good writer.
Yes.
And, but sometimes gets lost up his own spanking.
He's in need of the thrashing.
Yes, indeed.
From Miss Flaybum, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, so I do recommend reading League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, especially some of the later stuff.
One's mileage will vary, but at the end of the day, it's a master, both in storytelling and as an artist, doing some really interesting work that, like all great art, can have problems.
Yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely. And he was, if you look at the history of this, Alan Moore is coming off of Lost Girls, which was an interesting effort.
Yeah.
If anyone's, take a look at that.
Don't look it up.
Like I said, he's coming right off of that. And you can see some of that residualness. The residual storylines are still being in his mind, I guess. Overall, it's a really good series. Flaws aside, it's still a very good, very creative, very innovative story.
And as two English majors or former English majors, we didn't even do the deep dive into the vast amount of literary allusions,
yeah,
which is probably for the best for our beloved hundreds of thousands of listeners.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, you don't want a list of just things that, you know, oh, and then there's that thing, and then there's that thing.
Right.
But again, Moore does a good job of weaving these things together and making it part of the story instead of just references. It's not just Easter eggs for Easter egg's sake. It's actually relevant to the story.
Yes.
Okay. I think we both mostly like this, but as with all great art, you can admire something and still criticize it at the same time.
We would like our concerns to stand.
Yes. It's not black and white. All art is subjective. And you can like something while not liking all of it. There you go. So next time, Brian, an all-new episode of the Collected Edition. what are we going to be doing?
Oh, Paul, we're in for a fun ride. I seem to be stuck in a decade, so hopefully after this recommendation, I will switch things up a little bit. But for our next comic, we're going to read the 19-issue run of 19? The Shadow It's the late 80s DC version written by Andy Helfer and illustrated by a couple of young artists who I think have a future in comics. One of them is named Bill Sienkiewicz, and the other one is named Kyle Baker.
Yeah, I think they might have a career.
They might be all right.
Those young fellas.
It's the entirety of the 19-issue run. It is late 80s DC premium comics nuttiness.
Okay. Who knows where this will take us? The Shadow knows.
Only the Shadow knows. So, yeah, Andy Helfer, Bill Sienkiewicz, and Kyle Baker taking on the Shadow for 19 issues.
That's quite a hefty amount of issues, but I think it'll be a fun run. I have not read this, so it'll be exciting to get there, to visit this for the first time.
Well, we're in for a treat.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so that's next time. As for this, let us know what you think about the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Hit us up on Twitter at CollectedEdPod. That's CollectedEdPod. And go to our website, CollectedEdPodcast.com. Leave a comment. Anyway, like to hear your feedback. But until next time, until we meet again, my friends, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at CollectedEditionPodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@CollectedEditionPodcast.com or on Twitter at CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.